Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Barry Rook, new executive director for the National Campus Community Radio Association. He'll be telling us about his hopes for the continued growth of accessibility policies and stations throughout the radio union. So coming into the NCRA, what sorts of things do you hope to see in terms of accessibility?
Well, coming into a new role, it's a great opportunity to look at things from a fresh perspective. I'm familiar with the organization, with, for example, the Disabilities Handbook and some of the work that previous groups and committees have done. Not too familiar, but have the opportunity to look in and review that. So I think that's one of the important parts, is having a fresh set of eyes. I'd like to be able to see within the organization kind of a much larger push nationwide. I believe that the type of organization that we are, promoting accessibility, promoting equality and additional voices, means that we need to be able to be a leader within our industry and our own practices in order to show the listeners that we truly, really care about it. So one of the things that I think is important is that we provide opportunities for all of our stations to develop their own policies with guiding principles sent out to them, so that we can make sure that everyone, again, is online in a sort of a base level of accessibility, and that the different stations have the opportunity to address their specific needs one-on-one.
So how would you suggest going about reaching out to the communities that listen to these stations?
Yeah, it's a very challenging time when it comes to that, specifically because a lot of the times accessibility isn't really viewed as one of the most important parts. So I believe it really needs to be, especially with the changes that are happening both at a national and provincial levels across the country. So it needs to be put more onto the forefront. And I think it's sort of shifting back from more of a backseat to becoming that way. So I think a lot of what will happen is information being made available, information that is correct, information that is researched and able to be verified. And hopefully that will become common knowledge that these are the required changes that need to be made, so that when that information comes in, organizations that maybe are not as, forth-like, think very much about it, realize the importance of it, and now have the opportunity to address those accessibility needs, whether they're physical or other accessibility needs across the station.
So you mentioned you're familiar with the work that has been put into place. Do you plan on working in partnership with the accessibility committees established by the NCRA?
Yes, I think that's one of the most important things that happens. So someone who's helping to guide and organize the organization itself, working with the accessibility committees is extremely important. I have experience in the past with, first of all, drafting accessibility policy for a local radio station here in Guelph, which is CFRU. Which was great. It was a great start to a much larger policy around equity. But working in that I was able to draft it, work with a handful of different committees to make sure that it met those needs of the different organizations. And from there, taking that information and working with another committee. So we developed an accessibility committee and a working group. We would meet once a month to talk about different aspects of not only what the accessibility policy was written out, but what were the day-to-day challenges and the new challenges that arose with the ongoing work that has happened throughout the station. So from a much larger perspective of overseeing a national association that does that, I think that's really critical, that we set aside time to make sure that maybe the question of the incidents that come up on a week-by-week basis are addressed, but also to continue to review and add to the work that's already been done, because it really can't be something that you write, you say, great, we've done it, and then you put it aside and refer to it only as incidents come up. It's got to be a continuous growth. And that's why the committees themselves are the ones that actually drive it and allow for that change and reaction to incidents to have happen.
So in your time drafting accessibility policies, was there any one success moment that stood out for you?
I think one of the big ones was the policy that we had done before. Talked about a lot of the work that goes on the air, what programmers had said, and how the organization approached physical locations when it comes to doing events outside of the organization. So, for example, one of the moments happened when I tuned into the station. We had people that were on the air that were talking about events that they were putting and making sure that all the accessibility information was presented while the event was being talked about. So it was really quite nice to hear that individuals that weren't organized and part of the group in the accessibility committee were taking this as their own, realizing the importance and promoting it themselves. So now not only was it just programmer conversation about an event that they were hosting, but they even got into talking about why they wouldn't host events at these other locations because they weren't accessible, because they had challenges that maybe some individuals would have to deal with. So they changed different venues for it. They made sure that those challenges in the new venues were talked about to people who wanted to attend. I think that was really one of those kind of like, this wouldn't have happened a couple months before if the committee hadn't have done the work, the policy hadn't have gotten passed, and people hadn't really taken the policy and championed it as their own.
So if you could send any one message about the need for growth and change in accessibility policies, what would you say?
From a standpoint, I think it really shows that if you are looking at this as a challenge to take on and as a special need that needs to be completed, that stations and other organizations, nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations, can really be viewed as someone who is progressive, as someone who is thinking about the members, the clients, the listeners that they serve, and really realize that it all comes back very positively to the station. It shines a light on someone or an organization as being, thinking about others and actually caring rather than just complying. So I think that's sort of the biggest message that I get from it, or I would like to push out, is that it not only is it directly looking at the needs of those that want to access the organization or, listen or whatnot, but be active and involved. But it really helps to round out the radio stations, the nonprofits, the for-profits, and showing that they do care about everyone and those people that they serve. So I think that would be my answer to that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Not a problem. Thank you so much, Cam, for the time.
Of course. He had exactly the right idea during the interview, and so much as it has to be policies in action. It has to be people actually caring about the steps that they want to take. It's fine to draft a set of principles on paper and say, we're going to do this. It'll be a great support for individuals with disabilities. But that has to translate into something. It has to mean that we're going to look at event planning or week by week, just the individual matters that come up, and ask ourselves, how can we make this better? What can we do as an organization to really show our membership, to really show those in the community that we are truly committed to diversity? Now, diversity, I think that word has sort of been misinterpreted over the years, in so much as it's not setting aside a group. It's not telling them first they are a person with a disability. It's not emphasizing one characteristic. It's embracing those who have gifts and have skills to contribute to make sure that all the work within any given organization is of as rich a tapestry as it can be. Just by saying, somebody's coming at it from a different angle, a different perspective. There's nothing wrong with that. It's simply a matter of looking at another viewpoint. To me, that's what diversity really means. And for an organization to ask questions of individuals with disabilities or any other group, just to say, are we meeting your needs? Are we doing all we can to be supportive, to be an organization that you'd want to be a part of, that you'd want to do business with? By asking that question, it's the first step towards enlightenment. Knowing the needs of your clients is just good business practice. But knowing there are different perspectives, different ways of doing things, and accepting that one proven method is not necessarily the only proven method is the first step towards building a better workforce. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Don't feel alone. The Distress Center provides free, anonymous and confidential, caring and emotional support, referrals, crisis intervention, and suicide prevention by specially trained volunteers. They're open from noon to midnight. Sometimes talking does help. So call 519-256-5000.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Barry Rook, new executive director for the NCRA. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Dr. Graydon, executive director for the University of Michigan Depression Center. So tell me a little bit about the Depression Center.
The Depression Center, the University of Michigan Comprehensive Depression Center, an official name, was the first center of excellence focusing on depressions and bipolar illnesses and related disorders in the world. And it is an interdisciplinary gathering of experts and staff to try to conduct research, to translate that into better treatments, to take care of people, to educate others about how we could do this better, and to influence public policy. And it's also the home starting point for the National Network of Depression Centers to try to get a bunch of us working together on these efforts so that we can collaborate. And that includes Canada.
So how does depression typically affect a person?
Not well. The bottom line is these illnesses, and they are illnesses, if you go back and you start actually saying what are the symptoms, they're kind of textbook Chinese menu things. People associate sadness and crying. They don't enjoy things anymore. That's everything from sports that they once did to sexual activities to friends, family. They withdraw. They have decreased energy. don't spend time with friends. They essentially may have an awful lot of anxiety, sleep, appetite, weight changes. Sometimes people sleep too much. More often, they sleep too little. And with difficulty, they may have more pains. And I could go on, but I think what you're getting is an array of puzzling, pretty disabling symptoms that aren't fun and are really disruptive to one's work, one's family, one's children, and to even performance. So it's not a surprise that here we are in the United States, May is Mental Health Month. It's not a surprise that people don't know that depressions are probably the second most disabling disorder in all of healthcare.
So, how does the Depression Center go about working with clients?
The Depression Center is part of the University of Michigan health system and of the university itself. It is a clinical entity, so probably thousands of 50, 60,000 of patient visits occur a year. Second, it has many millions of dollars of research grants from the National Institutes of Health in the United States, from foundations, from donors. Third, it teaches, conducts national meetings, conferences. Here we are on an interview on a radio. And I think the goal is, how can we educate the public everywhere about these disorders so that there's greater willingness to find them earlier and treat them more effectively? Our goal is to not only help people with what we know now, but frankly to come up with really breakthrough types of treatment interventions so that these things can be treated with wellness, achieved, and then maintained, and ultimately can be prevented.
So, what sorts of challenges have you found in treating depression?
Probably, that's a great question. The two biggest, in my judgment, as the founder and executive director of the Depression Center, I would say are twofold. One is these disorders, as you and your listeners probably know, are still stigmatized. They still are kind of things that too many people don't understand. These are illnesses. Their causes even are being better understood. The brain is involved. And yet no one wants to talk about them. There still is, among some, a sense of shame. That is changing, and it's getting much, much less and much, much better. Probably because we do talk about it, and thank you for even doing something like this. But stigma is one of the barriers. The second one is they're underfunded. There is not enough research money, despite the fact that they're the second most disabling in the world and the second most costly. The dollars are too few to really take on breakthrough types of research strategies. And I think if you put those two together with the fact that they're highly prevalent, that's a jargon word for it, they're common. So one of every six of us has this, and so I've now listed three. So the challenges are they're everywhere, but no one wants to totally acknowledge that they have them, and we don't know enough, and yet we don't have the money to take them on to better understand. Did that make sense?
Yes. So, if you could send any one message about the need to overcome these stigmas, these barriers, what would you say?
The barriers are, these are illnesses. They're being pretty well understood. They have multiple causes. They're treatable, but we've got to go to those who recognize that one-size treatment will never fit all and find the right treatments. But if you have an illness and it's treatable, go get help. Illnesses that are treatable, we should go get help. And that's the real take-home message. A second one that's kind of an ancillary one is to get those better answers. we are going to have to collaborate. And so there are now many centers of excellence in the United States that have also begun collaborating with 6 centers of excellence in Canada. And ultimately, we need to go globally for these things. We're much more powerful when we're working together.
So, what are the next steps for the Depression Center?
The next steps are to, this will sound like jargon, and I'll see if I can explain it, are to really push for development of personalized, precise treatments for the different causes for depressions. What does that mean? If you were unfortunate enough to develop depression or bipolar illness, and I also had the same diagnosis, we may have different underlying causes. Some people are linked with trauma. Some are linked with stresses or abuse. Some are linked with head injuries. And many, many are linked with genetic underpinnings. We've got to find the right causes to have the right treatments. That's the research piece that we're working on. And the next steps are to really dissect those interactions and come up with treatment trials that say, this is what will work for me, but it may be different than what would work for you. And that's what's being done with cancers. We can do the same kinds of things with depressions, and we'll then have the breakthroughs that we seek.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
I find it truly amazing that in this day and age, conditions like depression are still stigmatized. The fact of the matter is, it's simply a medical condition. It's simply one facet of a person's life. And yes, if it's something that is inhibiting what we would call normal functioning, we should look at getting treated. But that doesn't mean the depression is going to become all-consuming. Doesn't mean it's going to take hold of a person's life and prevent them from achieving or accomplishing. If we as a society don't talk about it, how can we expect it to get any better? Are we so backward that we would say to ourselves, oh, we'll just ignore it, it'll go away, or I don't want to look upon this because it's unpleasant? Fact of the matter is, you're not going to make anything better pretending that it's not an issue. But putting up our own roadblocks isn't the way to go either. Saying to ourselves, yes, I recognize this is an issue, but I don't think there's any hope. I don't think there's anything we can do about it. It's a matter of recognizing and responding. Taking what information you can, making sure, of course, that it's reliable and good information, and then saying to yourself, this is what I'm dealing with. What can be done? What can help me to overcome or to thrive with these circumstances? And there's always a way. There is no life in this world that I would deem as hopeless, because the potential exists. As long as a person is in this world, they have the capability to achieve and to grow and to evolve and even to rise to circumstances. And yeah, sometimes it's not something we as a society are necessarily comfortable talking about. Look at it like this. 100 years ago, mental illness wasn't talked about at all, for all intents and purposes. People just assumed, we'll just shuffle these people off and, well, we'll just go on about our business. Hardly an effective approach. Until some brave few decided, this is something we need to deal with. This is something we need to do better with. And they were right. No issue gets better by shuffling it by the wayside. However, having the courage to look upon it to ask, what does it really mean, is how we can start building bridges of understanding. It's how we can come to a place where It doesn't look like this monstrous giant, this insurmountable obstacle, but it looks like a medical condition, something that has affected a person, something they didn't want, but something that must be dealt with, something that we as a society owe it to our members to understand and to deal with. Fact is, if a person has an injury, what's our first instinct? To help them, to provide whatever care and assistance we can. Why isn't it the same with those conditions that aren't as readily visible? If you see someone and you say to yourself, there could be something wrong, that instinct tends to be correct. But try reaching out to them. Try seeing if you can find what is really the issue. What are really the circumstances? And then, maybe, just maybe, you can be someone who can provide help for that. So what? Society in general may stigmatize certain conditions, which I really think was the key point of the interview, that yes, some people might stigmatize it, but the question comes down to the individual level. Are you going to be the one who stigmatizes it, or are you going to be the one who tries to understand it, the one who tries to make things better? That's why a center such as the Depression Center is so critical. It's a presence in the community that says, this is something we need to respond to. This is something that we can do something about. Because progress is only made in steps. You don't make colossal leaps very often. You don't just generally say, oh, I've got a cure now. No. You work up to it. And you work with those affected, and you work with the community. You establish partnerships, you ask the questions, and you find out what really matters on the individual level. If you can provide support, you provide it. And from there, you build a working foundation. The truth is, it's not about the big victories. It's not about all the moments where you can say, this is no longer an issue. It's about the little moments, making somebody's life a little better. In the end, yes, when these matters are no longer an issue, when we have cures or society can really overcome their own prejudice, their own stigmas, yes, those will be great moments. But until such a day arrives, it is about understanding. It is about finding our own meaning about what disability life really means. It's about asking ourselves, this is how society tends to view it, but how do I view it? What does it mean to me? If a person with a disability of any kind, whether it's something readily noticeable or not, they came up to me, how would I respond to such a person? And what impact could I have on their life? Because really, every person who encounters a person with a disability has the potential to change their life, for better or worse. It's the same in able-bodied relationships and community, because it's all about how one person influences another. How our words, how our actions, how we present ourselves, how that really impacts a person, and the long-term effect, the long-term emotional state it can lead to. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.